Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 168th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Jonathan Finn Holliday and Jordan Brady. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Warren Kaplan, and today we have Charlie Tyrrell on. He is a mixed media filmmaker. I mean, he has like a narrative background, but he also does documentary work. He does everything, commercials, and he had a documentary short at Sundance, My Dead Dad's Porno Tapes, which is excellent. And he also just made a new documentary short called Broken Orchestra that is just like visually so interesting and so cinematic that Matt and I were just like super stoked to be able to talk to him.
We had to talk to him. Yeah. You can check out both Broken Orchestra and My Dead Dad's Porno Tapes on the show notes at justshootapod.com if you want to check them out before we dive into things, just so you get a sense of how specific and visual these documentaries are. My Dead Dad's Porno Tapes was a Vimeo staff pick. It's kind of all over the internet. You may have already seen it. And Broken Orchestra is equally beautiful and exciting and is on topic.com.
If you can watch them before the interview, then I think the interview will be a little more meaningful. But if you can't, it'll also be great.
Yeah, we kind of add context where applicable. But what I love so much about this conversation with Charlie and the reason that we were so excited to talk to him is that he lends such a broad array of skills to and perspectives to his documentaries, right? So there's mixed media, there's animation, there's interview pieces, there's like found footage. It's all so fascinating. And we come to learn through this conversation with Charlie that not only is he a really skilled filmmaker, but he's an exceptionally skilled collaborator. He puts such an emphasis on finding great people to work with so that they can all specialize a little bit more. So it's not like Charlie is a one-man band of like doing the animation and then also is a cinematographer and XYZ. And I think it's a really wonderful illustration of why even when it's a small team, finding people to collaborate with that then have those unique skills really elevates the entirety of the project. It's just a reminder that like, collaboration is the name of the game with filmmaking, and Charlie is such a humble, gracious, smart, intelligent leader in that way.
Yeah, I also loved that we talked a little bit about how he got some celebrities to do the voiceover for his shorts and how to approach someone like that to get them in a way that that's a lot easier than if you were trying to get a celebrity to be in your movie, for instance, which I think is worth for people to listen to.
He's got the secret sauce, and you're going to learn exactly how he did it. So I can't wait to dive into our conversation with Charlie. But before we do that...
Before we do that, Matt, let me ask you, what have you been working on lately?
Yeah, so I'm wrapping up kind of a number of series that I've been doing at a television show. I'm kind of doing like field pieces and the digital stuff for a television show that's been running for quite some time. And it's really fascinating because they're about to go on hiatus. And so I've got a building full of coworkers who kind of have senioritis a little bit. Like they're talking about their vacation plans, and they're also excited, and they're feeling nostalgic and emotional about wrapping up this season and their summer plans and all of this stuff. And it's such a funny feeling that you only get, I think, from long-running television, right?
So, and they're all full-time, and you're kind of the freelancer that's
exactly.
visiting.
Yeah, I'm like, well, yeah, I'm going to be on a job in 2 weeks.
Do they get paid when they're on hiatus?
They do not get paid when they're on hiatus, but I think the real gift is just that they know...
that they have a job waiting for them after the end of
exactly.
the summer.
Exactly. So you can plan out vacation time is a really obvious thing for me, where it's like, I think you and I are always hesitant to book things too far in advance, because if something comes up, you hate to turn down a big job, even though you've got plane tickets booked. You know?
Yeah, freelancer's dilemma.
So I'm always very jealous of them knowing they have a winter break, a spring break, and a summer break. It's like, you know, it makes the lifestyle of television that much more appealing, because like when they're working nonstop. They are sprinting all the time, but then they have a real break, you know? And I think we have a handful of friends who are kind of in that mode now, where they're coming back and maybe they're going to pick up another project or day play. But, you know, after a number of seasons, it's just like, I'm going to have the good life a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting thing as an adult. Once you have kids, it kind of, you get back into that mm-hmm. mode of like, oh, it's spring break. Oh, it's winter break. Oh, it's summer break, because you have to figure out what to do with your kids when they're not in school. But as a freelancer, it's like those are the scary times in your life, because you're like, everyone's gone. Who's going to read my script or hire me?
Yeah. And I find that the summer executives who have paid leave and kind of know when their shows are up and running and when it's pilot season and all that stuff, they similarly will have some rhythms to their years that, you know, we would rather just work through. But, you know, if somebody is out of town, then all of a sudden, you know, the process just slows down in a way that can be excruciating to a freelancer.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, cool. Before we get into our interview with Charlie Turrell, we thought it would be cool to catch up with Jemai again. Jemai Youssef, who is a USC grad student that we've kind of been chatting with every few months just to see what the experience of being in film school is like.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Are you still in film school?
Yes, I'm still here. I have not dropped out.
Have many classmates had career changes? Has anyone dropped out yet?
So I have heard that a few people dropped out very, very early in the year, but I really don't remember them existing. Like, I don't know if this happened.
That's what happens when you drop out of film school. You no longer exist.
You're just erased from existence. Because it's a small program. So like, if they'd left an impact, you would remember them.
Yeah. Unless they just did it really early, like first week or something.
Yeah.
But we still have 60 people. So I don't see how we could have lost anyone. So, yeah.
Right. And remind me, at USC, do you specialize in like directing or producing or writing? Or is it everyone does everything?
So for the first year, we definitely all do everything, and you know, we don't even get to choose other classes. Like, we each take the same class. But I will say that from now on, people will kind of start to specialize, but it's not on an official level. Like, we all get the same degree, but at a certain point you can't take like all the different classes. Like, if you want to take intermediate directing, or you can take intermediate cinematography, and you kind of start heading down a path, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you kind of, you figure out the things that you like doing the best too, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So on that note, is there something that you're gravitating towards?
Well, in terms of classes, I'm actually going to be doing production design for a 546
yeah.
film.
I had a hunch actually. Because last time we talked, you were really into like kind of creating some sort of like creature effects sort of
mm-hmm,
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, like that kind of that arts and crafts element, I think, is really appealing to me. And I feel like I recognize that in you a little bit.
Yeah. So 546 is one of the like famous USC classes. It's a big advanced project where the school gives like $10,000 to the budget of the film. And it's a narrative fiction film. So the directors have to kind of like pitch, and there's like an interview process and stuff, and they get whittled down until there's just three of them. And then the directors and producers have to like pick their crews. So it was kind of like everyone's like interviewing, trying to see if they can, you know, get on a project. And it was basically like competitive. So, mm-hmm. yeah, so I'll be one of two production designers on this film. So, which is great because my partner has way more production design experience than I do. So that's, I guess you could say that's like a specialization, but I mean, I'm still here to be a director at the end of the day. So,
and would you say out of the 60 people in your class, how many of them are there to be a director? Is it close to 60?
I don't know, because now we're starting to see, you know, people who are getting to be really well known for things. Like, maybe they still want to be a director, but we all know them as like a really dope like cinematographer, or like they're really good at sound. So I feel like partially because of the way the professors kind of guide us, but people are trying to find their backup plan, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and they tell us, oh, you know, you want to be able to get a job after you graduate, like editing or doing sound. So I think people are also doing a little bit of that. So, I mean, we'll see.
So the undergrad equivalent to a 546 is a 480. And unlike grad students, like you'll have a thesis project, but for undergrad, the kind of group project is the big, big thing. Mm-hmm. And I was a production designer.
What? Oh, really? No way. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. That's why you production designed your last music video with zero worries.
Exactly.
Well, on that note of like having a backup plan and figuring out how to have like more of a guaranteed job when you graduate, Matt and I were curious what your plans were for this summer.
Oh, so I'm taking two classes. I'm taking one of our like critical studies kind of requirement classes on gender, sexuality, and the media. And then I'm taking a TV pilot writing course.
That's cool.
Yeah, I think we get to outline and like create a show bible, but we don't actually have to write a pilot in the class. That's my big thing. And I'm working like three different work study jobs at once also to kind of, you know, try to save up money. And right after the semester ended, I worked on a short film where I was the production designer, you know, starting to practice. So that was cool. And I might make a short film for my gender and sexuality class as well.
How many years is your program again?
Three years.
Mm-hmm. So you're just finishing up your first year.
Yep.
So you're probably not yet at a place where you're like trying to figure out exactly what you do when you graduate.
Well, that question, it's always there. Mm-hmm. And I just started working at the industry relations office. Part of the reason I was like, oh, maybe they'll help me. So sure, I'll figure out what to do when I graduate.
Tell us, what does the industry relations office do exactly?
So there are a couple different things they do. They have the film festivals and distributions division, which is where I'm kind of directly working under, which is cool because those are the people that really help you to like decide where to submit your short film to and really guide you in that process. And then there's like an internships person who helps in that regard and like looking at resumes and stuff like that. And then there's also like a talent development head, and they do this thing called First Jobs, which is a new program, I believe, which is really to help get recent alumni and like, recent grads connected with companies, you know, in the entertainment industry, and basically, you know, get them their first job. So that definitely looks really helpful.
Yeah, that's so smart, because it's kind of like an internship sort of experience, but also combined with work study, so you can make a little bit more cash than you would working effectively for free somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Did you think about getting a more industry-focused, like non-work study job or an internship or anything like that? Or were you just kind of like, I want to take this first summer to kind of continue going to school?
Well, I did think about internships, but I don't know if you remember, but I did one my first semester.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And My only thing is I kind of, like, the next internship I do, I would like it to be a paid internship, mm-hmm. if possible, just because basically if it's an unpaid internship, I kind of have to pay to take it because I have to, like, pay for that course credit. Mm-hmm. So that was the thing. It was kind of hard to find a paid internship. And I also, like, definitely wasn't proactive enough. And by the time I started thinking about the summer, it was already here.
Sure. Yeah. You're so, like, caught up in everything, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But but I did want to take classes, though. I had already, you know, wanted to do that. And I think a lot of us kind of stayed here over the summer to take courses.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I love summer school classes. Like, that is my recommendation to any student. If you're sticking around, especially, like, or if you have to pay for your, you know, lodging regardless, like, if moving home doesn't totally make financial sense, like, the amount of one-on-one time you get with your professors and the fun and ease and the different vibe that summer school classes have is just so awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a dumb question, but do they cost money?
Yeah, it's like the same, like the way they do it at USC is you pay per credit. So it doesn't really matter, I guess, what time you take it. Okay. It's still like how many credits it is.
Right. And so I guess my last question, and again, you're not even a year into school yet, but like, do you feel like people are starting to like kind of find their voice, or like, are you, like, is there anyone that you're like, oh, this person is going to make it? Like, they're just making stuff that is, like, so revolutionary.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So we just did – the class that we just took this spring was called 508. So every single one of us directed a short film, like, all 60 of us. And we had a big screening at the end of the semester. And I was, like – low-key blown away. I was just like, wow, we've grown so much since the first semester, and there's like so many people who are talented in all different aspects. And in terms of people having a voice, like, there are definitely people like who have a voice, not only in their directing and writing, but even in their cinematography, for example, where it's like, oh, I can tell you have like a distinct style, or with like production design and stuff like that. So I do think that people are really like rising, and I'm just proud of our cohort because I feel like there's a ton of talented people and we're all gonna make it. But yeah, I think we're doing great.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's good to hear. I feel like you always hear of people say like, oh, this guy or this girl, like when they were in film school, like you could already tell they were.
Everybody knew. Yeah, I would say in my experience, there's the person who is like extra, extra special that like everyone is talking about. And that person will find early success. And then everyone else will be kind of a surprised mixed bag.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? But I think that also some of that had to do with when I was in school, really, if you had money, you could shoot on film.
I see.
And so now that division isn't so great, I'd be curious to see how people land.
Yeah. And I guess I don't even know if there's just one person that is like the superstar. Because I also think that we're all so diverse, where maybe one person's really good at making like a very specific type of comedy, for example. So I feel like that also plays into it, where maybe I could see certain people doing really well in like certain like areas and genres.
Right. I guess I'm saying I went to school with John Chu, and he was a genius immediately.
there you go.
And Ryan Coogler too. Didn't he have some of that?
Yeah, well, I wasn't there when he was there.
Oh. I've heard. I don't know.
I just talked to someone this morning that went to school with Sam Esmail. They went to AFI together, and he was like, yeah, no one really expected. I mean, he was like, he was talented, but no one thought he was gonna.
No one was like, look out for Sam. Later,
gonna have this like hit show and, you know, direct like Julia Roberts and an awesome.
I think filmmakers like John are he's so charismatic, and he was so focused and driven that it was like that was what was appealing about him, and then also he had the chops. Whereas I think there's plenty of other filmmakers that aren't in the spotlight in the same way that, you know, you wouldn't immediately be like, oh, man, that's the one. You
know? Yeah. That makes sense for sure.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for giving us your insight into kind of what's going on and for checking in. We are going to check in more often with you. Before we say goodbye, I believe you had an unpaid endorsement that you wanted to tell us about.
Yeah, first of all, I'm excited to be part of this section, but I have been watching Chernobyl on HBO, and I think maybe one of you mentioned it before on the podcast, but I really want to endorse the Chernobyl podcast, which is, it goes into each episode with Craig Mazin, the writer, producer, creator of the show. And it's a really cool experience listening to it as like a film school student, because not only do they go into the writing, they go into some production aspects of it. And they talk about how they visited Chernobyl and like how they made some decisions with like production design, cinematography. And it's just really cool because it's a real time, like you watch an episode, then you listen to a podcast and you're like, oh, so this is what happened.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really cool. I didn't realize that they dive in, that Craig Mazin is on the podcast. You know, he's a professional podcaster. He's one of the people that inspired this podcast.
Haven't you heard he doesn't make any money on this, Oren?
Well, that makes sense why he's such a good podcast guest.
Sure, that's true.
Yeah, he has a podcast called Script Notes that is probably on like episode 500 or something.
I think it is.
Or 1,000.
It's either 4 or 500. I know they just hit a milestone. I was just listening the other day. It's great.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for the endorsement. And thanks for talking to us. And it's exciting that you're still in school and you're having fun and you have summer plans. And yeah, that's awesome. Let us know if you ever have anything, shorts or anything that we should tweet about. We'd love to do that.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully the film I made this semester, I'm submitting it to places. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, definitely we'll keep in the loop. And thanks for, still wanting to catch up with me.
Yeah. No, the real-time evolution is the thing that makes it so special, So thanks for making yourself available, too.
Yeah. I'm excited for year three to be like, you hate this town. Had a DreamWorks deal that fell apart.
When did Jemai start chain smoking?
We'll see.
I really doubt it. But
cool. Okay. Well, we'll check in with you later.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thanks so much, Jemai. Oh man, I'm so excited for Jemai. Sounds like she's had an incredible year, and she's looking forward to two more. I think we'll check back in with her when she comes back from summer break and see what. See what how the summer has treated her.
Yeah, it's always interesting to be in film school and know that you're, trying to aim for a career that is like so elusive. It's stressful in all the fun ways. Well, cool. Well, let's hop in with Charlie Turrell. Hey, we're going to take a quick break to talk about Plot Devices, one of our sponsors, and we have Seth Worley, one of the creators of the Story Clock workbook. So one of the cool things in the workbook is that you have an area to write a list of resources that you have.
Yeah, we have a whole page devoted to resources and challenges. For example, my first big short film, Plot Device, of which we pulled the name from the company. When I sat down to write it, I thought about like, what do I have at my disposal to work with? I know that I have my parents' front yard, which is very photogenic and very free. I have my little brother who looks like Shia LaBeouf and will do anything I tell him to for cheap. And I know we have this yellow button from a previous shoot that we had done that came 2 days after the shoot and that we still wanted to get on screen. So I crafted a whole story around this button and this location and actor that I had available. On the flip side of that, you're going to encounter challenges on any film set. If not, you're in a dream world, a fantasy land. I personally believe that a filmmaker's voice is found in how they respond to the challenges that are presented to them.
What kind of challenges did you have on Plot Devices?
Rain, constant rain. Props broke normally when I would pick them up and subsequently drop them. What's great about trying to anticipate problems ahead of time and breaking your sharks early on is to try to avoid those challenges and just lean into them beforehand, to go into the shoot anticipating the problems and having your creative solutions ahead of time so it can look like it was your ideal all along.
Hey, it's going to rain a lot. Let's make the scene set in the rain.
Yeah.
Right? Is that the move?
Or let's set it inside, or let's put it in the garage, mm-hmm. or let's lock it down and only get the coverage from these three angles. For example, it rained during our zombie sequence. And because of that, I had to keep the camera under a tent and I had to keep the people out in the rain for only a limited amount of time. So we had shelters available really quickly for them to run to. But I also limited my coverage, which actually helped us because we were emulating this George Romero zombie aesthetic. And if I'd gotten a massive amount of coverage in that scene, it wouldn't have felt as authentic. But I was limited to having to stay in one place, having to use my zoom lens gratuitously. And I ended up helping the aesthetic of that sequence.
Totally. Well, cool. If you want to find out more about Plot Devices and the various tools that they make to help you craft your story, check out plotdevices.co.
This episode, we're giving away a Story Clock workbook along with a Get Rich or Die Writing pennant.
Go to Twitter and tweet the most overused movie cliche that you secretly love and tag at plotdevicesco. For me, I don't mind a morning alarm clock scene. What time a character wakes up can really tell you a lot about them. I personally haven't used an alarm clock since I had a kid, so it's fun to see other people using them. Anyhow, if you don't want to wait to win, you can get 20% off your first order from Plot Devices right now with the code JSIPOD20 at checkout. Thanks, and we can't wait to see your tweets.
Charlie Tyrrell, welcome to the podcast. Charlie Tyrrell of My Dead Dad's Porno Tapes and Broken Instruments, the soon-to-be-released, or actually probably released by now, documentary on Topic.com. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank
Broken
you.
Orchestra, right?
Broken Orchestra. Sorry,
it's all Charlie. The same.
Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Charlie, I was so excited when we got the email about you potentially being on the show because I really loved My Dead Dad's Porno Tapes. I saw it as a Vimeo staff pick. And so I was like, oh, man, that would be so interesting to talk to that filmmaker because it's got such an awesome visual take on what could be in less skilled hands, just a kind of personal essay. It's almost like a storytelling piece that you could put up at the Moth, but you add this extra layer of like found object animation that's really beautiful. Talk to us about how that kind of came to be, how that became part of the style of the short.
Sure. Well, first off, thanks for enjoying the film.
And I want to just give a quick aside. If you are at home and you can pause this podcast and watch My Dead Dad's Porno Tapes on Vimeo, you absolutely should do that right now.
Yeah, and it'll be in the show notes as well, everyone.
So that you have some context. But if you haven't watched it yet, it's an amazing documentary autobiography, like one that I've never seen before. So you just got to watch it. Okay, go ahead, Charlie. Tell us about how you came up with your style.
And apologies for any search results that pop up while you search for the title of that film.
Sure.
You know, well, good luck. Yeah, so that film was something that I knew I wanted to make for a while, mostly born out of kind of, you know, among other things, this fear that I would one day lose the memory of my dad. So shaping that kind of turned into, you know, trying to chase down objects that belonged to him. And then in chasing down those objects, I found the porno tapes. And kind of as I got this pile, I started to look at it and realize, like, okay, this pile of stuff I have doesn't really say who he was, but some of the objects trigger memories and, you know, point in the right direction a little bit. So the only real way to kind of, for me to take that was to, you know, translate into the medium in which I work, which is film. And from there, you know, that was still, you know, years before the film was actually done. So from there, it was a matter of kind of recruiting the right people, getting, you know, working with team members that I trust and work with frequently, and, you know, allowing the thing to shape and become what it became. And as far as you say, being kind of seen in this objective way, you know, that was kind of necessary for, you know, not only my process in the film, but also my process in, you know, resolving and unpacking those feelings I had about my dad. It's in the third person, you know, narration because that was the only real way that we could write it. We couldn't write it in the first person because, you know, not only the dread of myself knowing that I would have to narrate it one day, but it also, it just kind of made the whole process feel weird and like trying to talk about these things and it just seemed so narcissistic and navel-gazy and that wasn't the film that I wanted to make, and that's not really the type of person that I am. So, you know, I consider myself more of a narrative filmmaker ahead of a documentary filmmaker, even though my short documentaries are the ones that have kind of, you know, had a bit more success and gone out there. But with that, you know, I work with more narrative structure in, mm-hmm. you know, nonfiction filmmaking. Yeah.
Your docs are like super cinematic. I was just talking to a documentary filmmaker yesterday, I was like, have you seen My Dead Dad's Porno Tapes? And he's like, yeah, you know, loved it. And then I told them a little bit about your next short and how, I mean, you know, there's just so much camera work and planning and, like, it seems like shot listing and doing all these things that I think you would kind of start doing in a documentary and then quickly go off course from. But in your work, it's like so organized, you know, so planned in a way that a documentary usually isn't.
Right.
Yeah, so well, formal. Yeah.
It's interesting that you say that, because I always feel like it's so unplanned. And even our animations, you know, we kind of jokingly refer to them as jazzimations, because a lot of them we kind of just have the objects and we have the materials there and we have the studio time and we just kind of make it up as we go.
Do you find that you're doing the animation in sequence or that you're kind of finding it in the edit? You know, because just for the listeners, it's like there's a lot of, you know, top-down photography of objects, right?
Right.
So it could be something where you... You know, do you know the sequence of the tiny little button to the metal to the driver's license to the wallet and so on?
To the floppy disk.
We kind of we edit as we go in the animating. You know, we start out with a rough idea, and then from there we kind of build and see what we have. I mean, for me, a lot of the way I've worked with animation and animators is it's defined by its kind of creative limitations and, you know, its budget limitations. Okay, we have an animator for this many days. We have this much studio. And in the case of my dead dad's promo tapes, we have this many objects. So let's try and exploit what we have as best we can and utilize it in the best way that we can. And there's only so much thinking you can do ahead of time. There were some shots that we knew what we wanted to land on or objects we wanted to include or, you know, rough ideas of images that we wanted to show. But really when we're there and it's starting on a blank frame, we kind of just look around and see what we have and go, okay, well, let's start this. And we kind of run through a couple tests. And then after we get the first couple shots behind us, that's when we kind of know our definition and our scope of how big these animations are going to be and, you know, where we're going to carry them and kind of get our bandwidth figured out. And by the time we're done animating, we can tell the editor, okay, this is the sequence of shots, but at the start, we don't necessarily know what that sequence is going to be. We have a rough idea and we have kind of, you know, a plan B, fail safe minimum. These are the shots that we need just to have a story, but then we try and, you know, embellish those and make them better, make them stronger as we go.
Yeah. A little bit of improvisation. So then do you have the sequencing already done? Do you have the voiceover and all of those pieces laid out or no?
Yeah, well, yeah. So usually if we can, that's ideal. That's not always the case, but at the very least, it's good to have, you know, a temp voiceover in there, an animation that's mixing footage, live action or archival with, you know, just empty slugs. Animation will go here. And then, you know, you input them as you go and you see what needs to be shorter, longer. Sometimes you have to redo some animations because, you know, they just don't feel right once you place them. And then there are other animations that you have to scrap. So it's kind of this game where, you know, it's filmmaking stress, but it's pretty peaceful too, because we aren't talking a full set of, you know, 30 people. It's myself and a team of, you know, 1 to 2 animators like Martha or Phil. And, you know, we just kind of try and keep it on a leash and dial it in as we get further. But, you know, I try and associate myself with people that, you know, really welcome creative challenges. And a lot of what that is kind of what I mentioned before, like, okay, here's our tools and here's our environment and here's kind of, you know, the maximum resources we have. And let's make these work as best we can. Like Chet, my cinematographer, he's always referred to as a Swiss Army knife, because you can give him a package truck and you can give him the best camera and the best lenses and it will look great. But if you're just giving him, you know, a 10-year-old whatever and 3 lights, he'll just go, okay, like, you know, I'll make this work. It won't be all that it could, but that might be better for this project if we are limited in this way, because we aren't going to be losing all that time on, you know, playing production and playing giant setups where it might not be necessary for the story.
Right. I love that phrase, playing production.
Yeah.
That's so good.
I think something that's interesting is, like, if you watch the short doc, it's Like, I mean, it feels like you made it about you, about your family. It's like, it feels like everything is like coming out of your brain.
Yeah, but it's literally a, like a plot point that it's the end card says directed by Charlie Tyrrell, you know?
Yeah, but then when you talk about making it, you keep using the word we. Like, we wrote it, you know, the editor did this, the DP did that. Like, how did you, like, take something that seems like so personal and so, like, of your voice, which is what I'm assuming it is, and, you know, get other people to buy into it, especially the writing part?
Luckily, it wasn't a hard sell. And I mean, again, associating myself with, you know, the kind of people I mentioned before, you know, we're usually all happy to work together again. So in this case, it was a team of people that I had worked with previously. We do have a good working relationship, and, you know, it was an idea that I knew I wanted to make, but I thought of making it alone and quietly and, you know, maybe show it to my siblings. But when I kind of started kicking the idea around to some of these, you know, fellow filmmakers, that was when people were like, oh, yeah, you need to make that. And it wasn't just like a gawky kind of, haha, that's kind of silly, and like maybe like a little bit kind of, you know, enticing for the wrong reasons, but, you know.
Salacious, maybe?
Yeah. But these people were like, no, that's a story that should be told and you shouldn't hold back. And one of the kind of early people was my co-writer, Joseph Beebe, who's, you know, he's a colleague that I know from film school. I've worked with him quite a few times, and he's worked all over. He's worked, you know, as an editor, as just a straight writer, director. So all this is a way of saying that he has a very good sense of story and a very good sense of structure. And what we did at the very beginning was he just interviewed me. We just met up, he brought his phone, recorded a conversation where it was like, okay, what do you want this film to be? What are kind of some anecdotes or story beats you want to hit? Just tell me everything. So I just kind of unloaded all these stories and all these anecdotes. And there were ones that I told him that I felt, this is the ending of the film, or this is a very important moment in this film, and this is something that we're going to include. But luckily, he has the ability to look at it, you know, completely as an outsider and just go, no, let's focus on this. This is what's interesting. And then from there, it just becomes a back and forth of shaping it, refining it. You know, I think we went through 30 drafts of that narration script. There's so many stories that we didn't include, ones that at the beginning we felt like we weren't going to use that ended up being so heavily featured. So it's really, you know, it's half luck and half just kind of curating your team, right? You hope that you get the right people to work with, but you can work with anyone if you put the effort into that relationship. And if you get a sense of each other and get a sense of, you know, tone and style and really shape it. Like a film at the end of the day is more of a collective body than any one person or one filmmaker, right?
Yeah, and yeah, absolutely.
And even with this film that is completely personal, I feel like I can't take credit for the project, right? Like I steered and I, you know, recruited and knew what I wanted it to be, but, you know, I didn't dictate every little bit and try and leave room for, you know, Michael Barker, the editor, to add his touches. And he added so much that, again, stuff I didn't even see from the beginning. And, you know, Julie and everyone else just kind of, it's good when you have that, when you have a team of people that can all not just be work for hire, but they can put a little bit of themselves into the film as well.
True collaborators.
Yeah.
Yeah. Charlie, what I love so much about this is that it feels like, in a certain sense, this film is a culmination of, you know, a lifetime worth of experiences and meditation on what it is to be a part of your family and an artist and a collaborator, right? Like, these are all relationships that it sounds like you've had for a long time. So maybe let's back out a little bit. I'd love to learn a little bit more contextually just about who you are as a filmmaker, how you kind of came to the process. Give us kind of the big picture of how you came to filmmaking.
Well, in like ninth grade, they make you do an aptitude test. And it was, you know, I knew that I wanted to work in the arts of some kind since, you know, probably elementary school. It was something that I had something of a skill for, something that I was comfortable in working in. And, you know, maybe superficially, it was I didn't know any other friends that wanted to do that as well. So I was able to kind of feel like I had my own thing and let that develop.
The filmmaking kid.
And you grew up in Canada, right?
Yep. Yep. I grew up about an hour outside of Toronto. But that being said, you know, we didn't have like a video camera growing up. I didn't get to really play around with filmmaking until I went into university. Like in high school, we had a communications class and we were able to do, you know, some kind of TV broadcast style projects and a couple short films. But a lot of that was more so just kind of goofing off.
And what about, so post college, like were you a working filmmaker? When did you start thinking about documentary and how did you have a background in animation? How did all of these different skills kind of come together?
I mean, that's a good question. I didn't have a background in animation other than, you know, a little bit of messing around. I do have a bit of a background in graphic design though. In high school, in high school, I was able to go to like most local concerts for free because I designed a lot of band posters and concert posters for, you know, a few of the venues. And as a result, they're like, well, we can't pay you for the work, but we can give you free tickets to whatever shows you want to go to kind of thing. So it felt like a fair trade off at the time. And it was kind of like, put this text on it, but other than that, do whatever you want. So, you know, I was appreciative of that and, you know, lets you flex a little bit of creative muscle while you actually, you know, get to walk down the street and see something that you did like on a telephone pole and then it's gone 2 days later. But, you know, so that was kind of my first real make something with an expectation that people will see it. And from there, I developed my sense of kind of, you know, imagery I like to work with, balance and tone of the imagery, and also, you know, sense of humor in it because at the time, like a lot of these were kind of, you know, hardcore and punk shows and stuff. And people were using some pretty serious subject matter, you know, anti-war, anti-military stuff. And it was kind of more, you know, in tune to my sensibilities to, you know, be a bit more sardonic with it and put a little bit of humor in the obscene. And you know, that was an early development I didn't really revisit until, I ended film school because, you know, film school, it was great. And there's a lot of collaborators I worked with there that I still work with to this day, like Joseph.
Where did you go?
Chet, Ryerson University in Toronto.
Okay.
Cool. And, you know, you do your assignments and you do your stories and, you know, felt good about maybe 10 or 20% of the work I made there. But again, I hadn't really worked in this medium. There are a lot of people in our course who had worked as PAs or, you know, did have jobs relating to film. So I felt like a little bit of catching up was required. So after school, basically, you know, did the traditional route of starting as a PA and, you know, working up and up. Then I was working as an assistant editor for a while and kind of had this realization that, you know, I could work like that forever. I could work, you know, on or offset, you know, at whatever production level, you know, job security was fine because I was, you know, proficient at what I was doing there. But, oh man, I'm not making my own stuff on the side. So I kind of stopped everything in its place, took the money that I had made and the money that I saved and, you know, kind of figured, okay, well, I'm going to try and reinvest this money into my own projects and, you know, do a lot of the freebies and favors and recruiting friends to volunteer on your shoots and, you know, working at it piece by piece, experimenting in, you know, more short films, some branded stuff, some little animated stuff.
And was My Dead Dad Porno Tape, was that the your big break, would you describe it as? Is that like the most attention you've received thus far, or did you have other kind of...
Before that, in 2015, I made a film called I Thought I Told You to Shut Up, which was about a comic book artist, David Boswell, and his character, Reed Fleming, the world's toughest milkman. So we premiered at South by Southwest with that film. That was my first kind of, you know, festival film thing that I got emails from people about. And that was kind of, the first one, but it was nothing compared to kind of the circulation and attention that Dead Dad's Porno Tapes has gotten, that's for sure.
And I see here on your on your Vimeo that "I Thought I Told You to Shut Up" is narrated by Jonathan Demme.
Yeah.
How did you swing that?
Yeah, it's also worth mentioning that David Wayne does my dead dad's porno tapes. So yeah, like, tell us
that's
about
the
both
move.
Of us.
You got to get famous narrators.
So yeah, good,
exactly.
Man. And, yeah, how did that happen?
Well, Jonathan Demme was a fan of Reed Fleming, the comic book character. And, you know, it took some time, but filtering through IMDb Pro and finding the right manager and person to reach out to. And, you know, eventually, if you can get them to read the email, usually the answer is yes. Like, but you have so many layers to get through. Demme was great. It's too bad he's gone now, but I was able to see that film with him at the Brooklyn Film Festival, so that was a cool experience.
So once you get Jonathan Demme to say yes, I guess on account that he's like a fan of the of Reed Fleming, the person you're making your documentary about, do you record him, or do you just say, like, how does that work?
We drove down to New York, and it was myself and sound recordist, and Joseph actually came, and, you know, we had the script, and I think it was, you know, when it's condensed, it's like 2 pages, so, you know, he was able to give some of his time, and we just went to his office and got it out.
And then, so what's the story with David Wayne?
Well, with David, like I mentioned before, we wrote the narration in the third person, you know, as a tool to get me out of my own head and make it not feel awkward as I was working on it. But then after a while, we really started to like the fact that I was in the third person, and it felt right, and it gave this quality of the film that we wanted to preserve. So we knew, okay, well, we should try and recruit a narrator. And, you know, recruiting a known name certainly helps a short film. And we had a mutual friend that knew David Wayne. So, you know, the dots all connected, and he helped us out and did it, and it was great. We did it in an afternoon, same kind of thing. But what was so great about David, and why we kind of jumped at the opportunity to work with him, was because, you know, we wanted someone that could do sincere. It is a fairly heavy narration, but, you know, we wanted someone that has a good tone of humor and a good sense of, you know, how to use it and how to read for it. And, you know, he was just perfect for that, because, you know, it wasn't just, okay, this part's funny, this part's sad. It's the nuanced kind of segues and in-betweens that he does. And yeah, he was just brilliant.
Yeah, what great casting. So smart. Because I think the other thing that I love, especially about the Wayne casting, is that, like, you're right. I think you think of David Wayne as like a purely comedic voice, right? He's so zany, and, you know, his body of work would suggest purely that he's just interested in comedy, right? Like, absurdist comedy, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think that must have been appealing to him to be able to do a slightly more dramatic side of his own persona as well. You know, like, there's that moment of like, wait a minute, is that David Wayne? You know,
exactly. And that's why I love about it, because you can see that there's some people that you can tell who knows, like, some people right away are like, oh, fuck, that's David Wayne. And the other people isn't that they don't know his work, but they just don't recognize him for that.
Right.
Right? They don't recognize him for that tone. So it probably was maybe, you know, something that, looking back, maybe it did help him, you know, come on board.
Yeah. 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 And I think is, like, again, low impact requests from famous people, right? So it's like, it's creatively appealing. You know, you had a little bit of cachet, right? Like, you had a short at South By already. The script obviously is really powerful and great. Sorry if you said this already, but did you have any sort of, like, anything to show him beyond what you just emailed? Like, what did he see to say yes to it?
I'm trying to remember if we did send him anything. I think we maybe had a clip. Now that I try to remember, I think we had the EKG sequence done, like the heartbeat sequence done for the film. So, you know, he had a sense that it was, you know, objects on a white background. And I can't remember if the temp narration was on there or not, but whether he saw it or not, and that's what sold him on it. You know, we never really got into that.
Sure. But I guess it's nice just to, for people to see, like, oh, this is going to be really polished and really personal and mm-hmm. really beautiful, and these guys know what they're doing, basically. I'm not wasting my time.
Yeah, and, right. and since the film has been completed and, you know, got out there, he's been so supportive and, you know, came out to a couple of the screenings that were in L.A., and, yeah, he's a great ally on the film.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it doesn't hurt him when he's, like, in a Sundance short also, right?
Yeah, well, actually, that was cool because his feature was premiering at Sundance. So we were both there with movies.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I feel like a lot of, you know, a lot of our listeners and people in our business, like, they try to approach, like, a celebrity. They're like, you know, you're only going to need to film for 3 days in Puerto Rico. Just come with us. Mm-hmm. Like, why would you say no? But then you look at, like, kind of your approach and, like, literally it's like almost impossible for them to say no. You know, you're approaching people that you have kind of some connection to, you're asking so little of them, and you're showing them why what you're asking them to do is going to be artistic.
Yeah, I'm coming to their house in the middle of the afternoon for 30 minutes, like, and then I'll be out of there, no equipment, no other bodies,
and with a huge impact. You know?
Well, you don't know that at the time, though.
Sure, sure, sure. But I'm in terms of, like,
but their the potential, like, footprint on the project. You're saying,
yeah, exactly, exactly.
Right.
It's like,
yeah,
he's the voice of the movie in so many ways.
Oh yeah, he makes the film, as far as I'm concerned. Any one part in this project is gone and it falls apart, I think.
So you got the success of My Dead Dad's Porno Tapes, right? And that's kind of making waves, and, you know, doing the huge festivals. Life is pretty good, and all of a sudden you find yourself with, like, a hit documentary. How did that lead us to Broken Orchestra?
Well, Dead Dad's Porn Tapes hasn't necessarily directly led to one job. It kind of validated me, is the best way I can explain it. You know, reach out to people or try to work with people, and normally the email just gets ignored, but because I now have that thing on my CV, people are like, oh, okay, like, sure, I can... It makes it easier to kind of open doors, but you still have to work at those doors. But Topic, actually, when we were at Sundance, Mona, who's one of the EPs on Broken Orchestra, she met up with Julie and myself and kind of, you know, explained what they were all about. And it's kind of like, okay, here's the card now. Like, you know, when you have something, reach out to us. So shortly after that, we ended up doing... a small series with them called The Book of Dog, which is, you know, a four-part web series about the way that, you know, humans have basically, like, bastardized certain dog breeds by inbreeding them and overbreeding them and kind of leaving them with all kinds of, you know, medical problems as a result of that. And actually on that one, we had a really great cast. We had Janine Garofalo, Lewis Black, Lucy Punch, and Fred Armisen. So that was nice. And, you know, same kind of thing, just reach out and email and hope that they say yes and all that. And then, you know, from there, after that, we've just kind of kept in touch, and I became aware of the Broken Orchestra and, you know, kind of put a treatment together, sent it to them. And, you know, after a little bit of review, they were like, okay, well, let's give it a shot.
And when you say you became aware of Broken Orchestra, is, like, once you're kind of, like, on the scene as a documentary filmmaker, you have a few docs, you had one at South By, one at Sundance, are people, like, emailing you, like, hey, I got a documentary?
No, nothing like that. A lot of kind of people, friends, making the lame joke, like, aha, you should make a film about that, which, funny, and it's kind of whatever. Right. But I'm never really actively seeking documentary subjects. You know, you kind of just have to follow your own interests, and then... if you find something, great. If not, I still work in narrative film for the most part, so I'll just stay in that space. But for The Broken Orchestra, I first read about it, you know, just in an online article, and, you know, it appealed to me. I didn't consider it as something I'd want to make a film about right away, but this was just before Christmas, and my sister-in-law is a violin player and a violin teacher and piano player and piano teacher, but... you know, they live on the other side of the country, so mailing Christmas gifts can always be a little bit tricky. And I found out through this program that you could adopt instruments, and you could adopt them in the name of someone else. So, you know, I figured, okay, that's a suitable and nice Christmas gift for her, and, you know, did that. And you know, went over well. But after that, I found myself, I kept thinking about it, and I kept thinking about the story and thinking about, you know, visually the things that I could do with that story. And, you know, this was right around the time that we were premiering at Sundance. So I reached out to Robert Blackson from Symphony for a Broken Orchestra and, you know, just let him know who I was, what I was about, sent him, you know, my most recent film, which was Dead Dad's Porno Tapes, and just asked if he'd be open to it. And luckily he was, and, you know, the relationship developed from there.
And then, so your idea was, I have a pitch basically to do a documentary about this topic. I'm going to bring it to Topic and see if they want to finance it.
Pretty much. Yeah. It was kind of more so we finished the Book of Dog with Topic and they're like, what else do you have? So, you know, we sent them a list of things and Broken Orchestra was one of them.
Well, so I like love the visuals of Broken Orchestra, the way you basically kind of weave these documentary recordings into like a cinematic backdrop. Like, how did you come up with that idea?
Well, from the start, it was something that we knew that we wanted to make with animation in some kind of format that, you know, was a bit less traditional in nonfiction films. To get where we actually got to with, you know, the camera wandering through these hallways with the old busted TVs on AV carts, you know, that actually came during the process of making the films and being down in Philadelphia and being in some schools and doing the interviews. It was...
That's so fascinating to me, Charlie, because that is... It's so
intentional, right?
It's so intentional and so evocative, right? But also, it's like so much of the film, right? Like the main... And just for listeners who haven't had the chance to see the film yet, you know, most of it is cameras kind of drifting through these different classroom spaces and the TVs, like these old tube TVs, playing interview footage as we kind of glide past them. So it is, you know, maybe the primary mechanic of the film. And so to hear that it's kind of...
That wasn't the pitch.
That it was just this kind of like inspiration point for you, like in mid-process, is so fascinating and so inspiring.
Right. Well, I mean, I knew that we would have these interviews and... It's like I look at things kind of and can compartmentalize them. I'm like, okay, if I just have interviews, I'll find a format. I'll make something work. So, you know, I knew that we would be able to make that footage work for us. And to get where we got, you know, it became what felt right as the project went on. And, you know, a lot of that, like I said, was being in these old high schools, because I haven't been in high school since I was in high school, you know, over a decade ago. And just the experience, and a few of us shared this, you know, we were just a small team of, you know, four down there, but, you know, we were all kind of like, whoa, this is, you know, flashbacks and nostalgia and all that. And, you know, it's kind of incredible that we can be, you know, in a high school over 1,000 miles away from where we grew up, but it's still the exact same. You know, the only thing that we noticed that was different about American high school is that you guys have, metal detectors.
Not everyone.
Well, yeah, this particular high school, it did. And but that being said, I was found myself relating to the story even more being there and interviewing our subjects, and they're all so compassionate, and so, you know, they aren't just involved in, you know, the project and their community. They really believe in what this project did. So, you know, I was kind of, you know, being more and more sold on it every day. So I knew that because I was feeling that in that environment of a school, that maybe trying to replicate that would be something worth entertaining. And we kind of, as we uncovered it, we realized, okay, like if we put this in schools and, you know, we make that the main backdrop of the piece, then people watching and listening to the story, they aren't just going to, you know, hear these subjects and, you know, ABC of the story. It might help kind of put them back in their old school and their old environments and, you know, empathize a little bit with the story that's going on, because they'll be able to relate to it from their own experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's so beautiful and so evocative. You know, Charlie, I have a couple technical mm-hmm. questions. Can we jump into that? So, first of all, how many TV are all the TV carts real? or did you have to do some cloning? Because there's a couple of instances where it's like, oh, there's a lot of TV carts here. Are you adding any things in post? And then also, I suppose you're superimposing the...
Perfectly timed interviews.
Perfectly timed interviews have to be done in post.
Oh, correct? No, it's all real.
Oh, man.
No way. All the interviews are playing on the
yeah,
TV.
You can see... We didn't try to hide it, but you can see all the wires connecting the TVs. We were trying to find a way how to basically play footage back on multiple TVs at one time from one source. And the only real way that we could do that was actually, you know, the old school coaxial cable. So we had hundreds and hundreds of feet of that, and we were running it all from, you know, a central kind of laptop playing the footage back at one time.
So there's no VCR.
There's no VCR. It's just all, we had to find this, you know, a converter that went from, you know, a laptop to HDMI, then a converter that went from HDMI to RCA, and then a converter that went from RCA to coaxial, and then coaxial splitters like that.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.